Well, here we are. We made it to Wednesday, almost halfway through the week. It is the 8th of April, 2026, and it's time now to begin the reading of the Wall Street Journal. With the Wall Street Journal, we say hello on this Wednesday to George and Steve.
Thank you, John Shea, and welcome. It's our great pleasure to read for you this morning. We'll begin with a What's News column on the far left side of the front page of the journal. These are news briefs that most of which, probably all of which, we'll get to in detail as we move through the paper today. Trader fatigue helped to shape a muted close for major U.S. stock indexes, with the S&P 500 rising less than a tenth of a percent, the NASDAQ gaining a tenth of a percent, and the Dow Industrials falling two-tenths of a percent. Pershing Square said it offered to buy Universal Music Group in a deal that values the world's largest record label at about $60 billion. The Treasury Department proposed regulations that it said would fundamentally reset the U.S.'s anti-money laundering rules, handing banks another victory. The U.K. barred entry to Kanye West following a backlash over a planned performance at a London music festival and the rapper's history of anti-Semitism. Elon Musk is working with Intel on his TerraFab project, which aims to build specially designed chips for SpaceX, XAI, and Tesla. Anthropic is preparing to arm some of the biggest technology companies with tools to find and patch bugs in their hardware and software. Novo Nordisk launched its higher-dose Wegovy weight loss shot in the U.S. after regulators cleared it for distribution there. Gilead agreed to buy German biotech company Tubulis for $3.15 billion to expand its portfolio of a cancer technology that aims to better guide chemotherapies to tumors. And finally, Delta Airlines will increase fees for checked bags on domestic and select short-haul international routes as carriers look to offset soaring jet fuel costs. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, George. Traders raced to bet before deadline. After ceasefire is announced, oil prices fall, stock futures and Asian markets rally. Article by Vicky G. Huang and Hannah Aaron Lang. In the hours before President Trump agreed to a two-week ceasefire with Iran, Ariel Itzhak spent Tuesday preparing for Trump's 8 p.m. deadline for escalating attacks on Iran. His plan? Bet against any rally. Itzhak, a retail trader and software business owner in Miami, expected the war to drag on markets even if Trump backed away from promised attacks on civilian infrastructure such as bridges and power plants. That meant spending the day tracking social media for signs of another reversal. The sentiment is just all over the place, he said. Nobody knows what's going to be the next move. The Dow Industrials ended the day 0.2% lower. The S&P 500 gained less than 0.1%, and the NASDAQ Composite rose 0.1%. Consumer discretionary stocks were among the biggest decliners in the S&P 500, extending a slump fueled by fears the war will drag on economic growth. U.S. crude futures settled at their highest value since June 2022, in the months after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But in trading Tuesday night after the Trump announcement, U.S. oil was back below $100 a barrel, down about 15% to $96.06 a barrel at 11 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. S&P and Dow futures were both up about 2% Tuesday night. Overseas, Japan's Nikkei 225 rallied 5% at the midday break Wednesday. In early trading Tuesday, stocks slumped, and U.S. oil futures briefly topped $117 a barrel after the U.S. struck military targets on Iran's Karg Island, and Trump escalated his threats against the country ahead of his evening cutoff to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Major indexes rebounded, and oil fell and after settlement trading, following reports that Pakistan had called for a two-week extension to Trump's deadline, moves that highlighted how sensitive markets remain to news about the Middle East. Since the war began roughly 6 weeks ago, monitoring the president's shifting ultimatums and social media pronouncements has become a part of the job for Wall Street pros and individual traders alike. But given that the president retreats from his most extreme policies often enough that the move has its own acronym, TACO, that's T-A-C-O, for Trump Always Chickens Out, prepping their portfolios for both de-escalation and the U.S. blowing everything up, has proved a challenge. Many traders say they are mentally worn down by the daily drip of headlines. Some are staying on the sidelines, waiting for a concrete development or a definitive end to the war before committing to a major trade. Trump's threats that a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, weighed on markets Tuesday, along with the Karg Island attacks, which U.S. officials said didn't target energy facilities on the key oil export hub. The president has apparently drawn a line in the sand, which he has changed before, said Michael Sheldon, vice president and senior portfolio manager for Washington Trust Wealth Management, before the announcement of the ceasefire. He added that he was on pins and needles, like everybody else. Luke Cannon, also before the announcement, a trader on the decentralized exchange Hyperliquid, said he expected the deadline to be extended, or that things will continue in the current status quo. He bet against Bitcoin, Ether, and some smaller tokens while holding a small position in gold on Hyperliquid, a 24/7 trading venue where people can trade perpetual futures tied to assets from Bitcoin to oil. That community began preparing on Monday when more than 800 viewers joined a live stream of Trump's press conference on X, hosted by HyperDash, a real-time analytics platform for Hyperliquid. The broadcast featured a dashboard that tracked live price action for Bitcoin, gold, crude oil, and the S&P 500 on Hyperliquid, alongside the president's remarks. Cannon was spending Tuesday glued to the messaging app Telegram and news feeds for development about the war. He remained skeptical of a market rally, adding that the war has increased inflationary pressures on the economy, effectively taking interest rate cuts off the table. There's a scenario where even Trump tacos, you get a quick pump that then sells off as people realize that the world is still going to be messy for the future, he said. Kirby Ong, a 33-year-old trader based in Singapore, said he was closely following the developments as the deadline approached. He planned to keep a pulse on the market via X and Telegram. He said that if the conflict escalated overnight, he would potentially bet on oil and gold, where he expects a short-term spike. With this kind of uncertainty in the markets, we tend to get wild swings in both directions, and over-leveraged positions usually get punished. So I'm waiting for a clearer picture, said Ong. Hanson Beringer, managing director of crypto market maker Flowdisk, said he has seen more people buying Bitcoin and HYPE tokens, the native token of Hyperliquid, while betting against oil-linked perpetual futures on the decentralized exchange. I hope that cleared up a lot of things for you, Josh.
Crystal clear.
Yep.
Thank you. It was only you can do it.
Thank you,
Steve. The day Trump's threat gripped the world, it's run by Wall Street Journal staff. At 8.06 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time Tuesday, President Trump issued the most dramatic ultimatum of his presidency. Unless Iran struck a deal in the next 12 hours, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, end quote. Even for a president who has long relied on maximalist threats, the 85-word post was startling. It ricocheted from the Oval Office to foreign embassies and corporate suites, setting off a countdown to Trump's 8 p.m. deadline and a frantic global guessing game over what the world's most powerful man was prepared to do. Less than 90 minutes before his deadline, Trump backed down, writing in a social media post that he had agreed to a two-week ceasefire with Iran and would suspend his threatened strikes subject to the immediate reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. Trump has spent days warning that he would bomb Iran's bridges, power plants, and other civilian infrastructure, insisting the country's people, quote, would be willing to suffer that in order to have freedom, end quote. As he appeared to threaten to destroy a country of 93 million people, he also seemed to leave the door open to a deal to avert the calamitous strikes. Who knows, he wrote on Tuesday morning. We will find out tonight, one of the most important moments in the long and complex history of the world, end quote. As the hours ticked by, everyone from Pope Leo to actor Ben Stiller called on Trump to back down. Administration officials fielded phone calls from executives and political allies trying to decipher whether Trump's threat was a bluff or a prelude to an escalation. European officials huddled on a call and largely convinced themselves that Trump would back off. On Wall Street, traders and executives treated the day like other Trump deadlines that have come and gone, as a negotiating tactic they largely expected to pass without catastrophe. Trump's social media post lighted up group chats across the globe and set off a scramble by U.S. allies and mediators to find an off-ramp or buy more time. As his threat made the rounds in Iran, many residents prepared for power and gas to go out and debated whether it would be safer to stay in the city or decamp for the countryside. Some dusted off old camping stoves and refilled oil canisters. When the pain becomes deep enough, the fear fades, a 42-year-old Iranian woman said, citing 5 weeks of war and years of repression and economic crisis in the country. Less than 30 minutes after Trump's post, Iranian officials told Egypt that Tehran had cut off direct communications with U.S. negotiators, according to officials from an Arab government. Officials from multiple Arab governments warned that the president's threat would likely have the opposite effect on Iran's hardline Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which has signaled that it would plunge the region into darkness if Iranian infrastructure was attacked. Trump's post made headlines in Israel as people there were getting ready for the end of Passover. Former Israeli President Prime Minister Ehud Olmert read the message just before sirens warning of an Iranian missile threat went off in central Israel and sent him into his home's bomb shelter. "I tend not to accept the statement by President Trump at face value," Olmert said from his shelter. "I want to believe what he meant is we will destroy the regime. I don't think we can accept any destruction, total or partial, of Iranian civilization." At 9 a.m., Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Joint Chiefs Chairman Daniel Kane logged on to their daily secure video conference with Admiral Brad Cooper, commander of U.S. Central Command. Cooper and military planners at the Pentagon have been preparing for potential strikes on Iran's energy infrastructure, according to two U.S. officials. Military planners pulled out existing target lists that had already been reviewed and vetted by military lawyers. Officials said the list of targets was far fewer than Trump's threat that every power plant in Iran will be out of business, burning, and exploding. Each target was legally viable, officials said, because it had a clear connection to Iran's military and security forces and wouldn't harm the civilian population excessively. Overnight, U.S. military pounded more than 50 targets on Karg Island, but didn't strike oil infrastructure, according to U.S. officials. The entire department serves at the discretion of the president and will execute his military objectives without fail, Pentagon spokesman Sean Purnell said. Steve.
Analysts are slow to recognize a crisis. There's an old joke about two economists walking down a busy street. One points to a $20 bill lying on the sidewalk. The other one keeps walking since, if it was really there, someone would have picked it up already. Market efficiency is one of the most important ideas in finance, but investors can take it too literally. It's possible the stock market's mild reaction to the war in Iran, the S&P 500 is down by just 3.9%, reflects everything smart people know about the conflict's economic effects. Just as the market is prone to overreact, though, it can be surprisingly slow to grasp the gravity of a major crisis. A big reason is psychological. It takes a lot of evidence to convince people something unthinkable might be about to happen, like major banks collapsing, a pandemic, or actual fuel shortages. Another culprit is a misplaced faith in Wall Street's small army of well-paid seers. 5 weeks seems like long enough for estimates of the damage from an energy shock to seep into analyst forecasts, but that isn't how it works. Since the start of the conflict, full-year earnings per share forecasts for the S&P 500 as a whole have risen slightly, according to bottom-up numbers from FactSet. More specifically, forecasts for 131 companies have risen, and those for 103 have dropped. The remainder are either unchanged or barely changed. The big rises are mostly no-brainers. Most are in the energy, refining, or chemical industries. Analysts who don't update those numbers would look dumb. Ditto for those seeking the biggest forecast reductions, such as airlines and travel-adjacent companies. The rest had recent bad news, like Nike and Campbell's. How can 268 companies' forecasts be unchanged for a fiscal year that had 10 months remaining, for most of them, when the war started? Even if the U.S. is mostly insulated from fuel shortages and travel disruptions, customers and suppliers of America's multinational companies aren't. The explanation is how analysts work. A problem has to be meaningful for management to tweak its guidance near the end of the quarter. The one that ended last week wasn't affected much. In the rest of 2026, Many companies have already been in their unofficial quiet period for weeks, so even subtle messages in the investor community are frowned upon. Fearful of angering executives, most analysts wait for the company to flag problems. Yet it would stand to reason, for example, the McDonald's, which has thousands of restaurants directly in countries under fire, and thousands more in places starting to experience fuel shortages, would be affected. One might expect an even bigger impact on a company like DoorDash, since gasoline directly affects the cost of food delivery. Yet, forecasts for those and other consumer-facing companies such as Mondelez, Chipotle, Starbucks, and PepsiCo are unchanged. More companies than usual will be sending the market a message through their guidance or the tone of their investor calls in coming weeks. Earnings season is going to be interesting. George.
Thanks, Steve. Activist launches $60 billion Universal Music bid. It's written by Gareth Vipers. Bill Ackman's Pershing Square Capital said it had made an offer to buy Universal Music Group in a deal that values the company at about $60 billion, the latest attempt by the activist investor to land the world's largest record label. The deal for the company that works with Bad Bunny, Taylor Swift, and the Beatles, if approved, would close by the end of the year and would involve Universal merging with Pershing Square Spark, that's SPARC, Holdings, a specially created acquisition vehicle. The new entity would be based in Nevada and would shift its stock listing from Amsterdam to the New York Stock Exchange, Pershing said. UMG's stock price has languished due to a combination of issues that are unrelated to the performance of its music business, and importantly, all of them can be addressed with this transaction, Pershing's chief executive Bill Ackman said on Tuesday. Universal counts some of the world's biggest selling artists on its books, including Bob Dylan, Kendrick Lamar, Elton John, Coldplay, and Billie Eilish, one of the big three record labels alongside Warner Music Group and Sony Music Entertainment. The company commands a market share of more than 30% of the global recorded music business. Universal didn't respond to a request for comment. Universal's other major shareholders include French billionaire Vincent Bolloré, Vivendi SE, and China's Tencent. Together, they control substantial voting rights in the company. Any deal will require a two-thirds vote to pass, according to Pershing Square's proposal. Split between cash and stock, Ackman's proposal rests on several assumptions about the future company. At 30.4 euro a share, the equivalent of $35.15, the current stock outstanding would be worth more than $63 billion. Valuing the deal, however, is complicated, according to investors. Pershing Square said the deal would enable the new company to extinguish 17% of its shares, leaving an equity value of around $58 billion after the payment of the cash component. That figure assumes the value of the new company's shares will be worth substantially more than those of the existing one. Pershing Square, this is possible because under the plan, the new company would take on $5.4 billion in debt and sell its stake in Spotify for $1.5 billion. It is also basing the future share price on its forecast for future earnings. Another measure of the deal's value, current shareholders can request to receive all shares or all cash. If enough shareholders take only stock, those receiving all cash would receive 22 euro a share. Pershing shares traded up around 11% on Tuesday at €19.6 a share, or around 35 billion euro in market capitalization, below Pershing Square's proposed valuation. The current share price is only slightly higher than the 18.5 euro reference price during the company's 2021 initial public offering. As part of the proposal, Pershing Square said the new company would appoint a fresh board of directors, which would include former Disney chief Michael Ovitz. Ackman's interest in Universal dates back to 2021, when he tried to use another investment vehicle, Pershing Square Tontine, to invest in the label. Steve.
Novo Nordisk unveils Wegovy HD in U.S., article by Dominic Chopping. Novo Nordisk launches higher-dose Wegovy weight loss shot in the U.S. after a new treatment gained regulatory approval here, Allaire, last month. The Danish drug maker said Tuesday that Wegovy HD is now available nationwide through more than 70,000 pharmacies, its online pharmacy, certain health telehealth providers, and other outlets. Wegovy HD is a once-weekly injection that contains 7.2 milligrams of active ingredient semaglutide, offering the highest weight loss of any Wegovy injection so far, the company said. In a trial of adults with obesity but without diabetes, patients taking a 7.2 milligram dose of Wegovy over about a year and a half lost 21% of their body weight on average, while around 1 in 3 people lost 25% or more of their body weight. Prior to the launch of Wegovy HD, the highest available injection was 2.4 milligrams of semaglutide, which has shown to help patients lose around 18% of their body weight on average. A higher dose of Wegovy was approved by the Food and Drug Administration nearly 3 weeks ago under an accelerated approval process based on the results of the trial. The approval follows decisions from the European Commission and British regulators earlier this year that allowed a Wegovy dose of up to 7.2 milligrams a week administered as three separate shots of 2.4 milligrams. The decisions mean that adults with obesity in the UK and all 27 European Union countries can now take the 2.4 milligram dose of Wegovy for at least 4 weeks and then move up to 7.2 milligrams if they need greater weight loss. Novo Nordisk has applied for approval of a 7.2 milligram single dose pen in the EU and UK, with a decision expected in the second half of the year. The rollout of higher dose Wegovy shots comes as the drug maker broadens its offerings in the booming weight loss market, having started selling its Wegovy weight loss pill in the U.S. at the start of the year as it awaits regulatory approval of the pill in the EU and UK. Rival Eli Lilly began shipping its own obesity pill in the U.S. on Monday. And I think we'll do one more article here in the business and finance section of today's Wall Street Journal. U.S. exporter sees bonus from the energy shock. No, I'm not going to do that one. I think I already drew that one, George.
Which one?
You weren't here. U.S. gas exporter sees bonus from the energy shock.
I don't know.
Would you like
I
to
got
read
one.
That? You have it? You have one ready?
I do. Office buildings sell at fire sale discounts, written by Peter Grant. U.S.'s battered office market is holding a fire sale featuring some buildings marked down by more than, wait for it, 90%. In Chicago, real estate developer Mark Calabria bought a 485,000-square-foot office building for $4 million. The building sold for $68.1 million a decade ago. Developer Asher Luzzatto paid a mere $5.3 million for the Denver Energy Center after a foreclosure process. The two-building complex sold for $176 million in 2013. Even the federal government's landlord is getting in on the act. The General Services Administration sold last month a 940,000-square-foot building to a residential converter for $24 million, a tiny fraction of its value a few years ago. Landlords and their lenders held onto their office towers for years, hoping for a turnaround after COVID. Now they are accepting enormous losses. Owners and creditors are capitulating to the reality that more employees are splitting their work time between home and office. They're also resigned to stubbornly higher interest rates, which lower property values and make it harder for buyers to borrow. People who don't know real estate would be shocked at the level of distress, Luzzatto said. Not every office building goes for a few pennies on the dollar. These are mostly poorer quality buildings, often in undesirable locations, and owners of high-end office towers in the best locations of New York City and the hottest parts of San Francisco are raising rents and selling buildings profitably. But most office sales reflect the sector's deep decline. Even higher quality properties on average have dropped about 35% in value from their peak, according to analytics firm Greensheet. Buyers, meanwhile, are picking up office towers in major U.S. cities for roughly the price of a three-bedroom condo unit in Manhattan. These distressed sales are paving the way for new owners to pursue redevelopment ideas that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. Calabria in Chicago plans to convert the office building into an urban farm and education center. He's working with Farm Zero, which will use grow lights and hydroponic farming techniques to produce millions of pounds a year of berries, tomatoes, lettuce, herbs, and other vegetables. The buy-in at this distressed price allows us the opportunity to afford change, Calabria said. Rock-bottom prices are also accelerating the move to residential conversion. Developers who bought at steep discounts can now justify costly structural changes, such as carving out atriums or reconfiguring floor layouts that would have been financially unworkable at higher valuations. At the start of the year, more than 90,000 apartments nationwide were in the process of conversion nationwide, up 28% from a year earlier, according to data firm Rent Cafe. New York City's obsolete buildings are leading the way, but tax breaks and other government incentives are helping spark similar projects in Chicago and Washington, D.C. Steve.
And this article is in the U.S. News section of today's Wall Street Journal. Why more are leaving the U.S. job market? Article by Gene Whalen. The U.S. labor market bounced back last month with healthy job growth and a decline in unemployment. But another trend also came into focus, the continuing fall in labor force participation. The share of the working age population that is either working or looking for work, known as the labor force participation rate, edged down to 61.9% in March, its lowest level since 1977, outside of the pandemic. The rate has been gradually falling since the early 2000s, largely due to the aging population. It nosedived in the early months of the pandemic, then rebounded and grew for a while before resuming its downslide in 2024. The continued aging of the population and the Trump administration's immigration crackdown have helped drive the fall in recent months, economists said. The rate matters because it helps set the pace of economic growth. The economy grows either because more workers join it or because each worker produces more. A labor force participation rate means slower long-run economic growth, said Gus Focher, chief economist at PNC Financial Services Group. Fortunately, U.S. productivity growth has been above historical averages for the past several years, said Greg Dacko, chief economist at EY Parthenon. That has essentially partially offset the slowdown in the growth of the labor force, he said. But there's an open question as to how much more productivity growth we'll get in the coming years, he added. The participation rate has been under pressure since the baby boomers started retiring in the early 2000s, a trend that has continued in recent months as younger boomers reach retirement age. Early retirement among workers 55 and older has been another factor. The pandemic prompted many in this demographic to leave the workforce before 65, and the trend has continued. The labor force participation rate for Americans 55 and over has fallen from 40.2% in January 2020 to 37.2% last month, the lowest in more than 20 years. The administration's immigration policies have been another drag on the participation rate. Lower levels of immigration, along with deportations, have cut off a pipeline of young residents who come to the country specifically to work. With immigration declining and fewer people entering, we have aged our workforce in a more rapid way, said Laura Ulrich, an economist at the job search site Indeed. Over time, a lower participation rate could spell more trouble for the U.S. economy because we are also at some point going to be experiencing declines in population, Ulrich said. A smaller pool of potential workers combined with lower participation rates within that pool could lead to labor shortages in some areas, she said. On a positive note, the participation rate of people ages 25 to 54 has held near multi-decade highs. Evidence the overall decline in participation is tied more to the aging population and immigration shock than to people struggling to find work and giving up, economists say. George.
Thanks, Steve. And Steve, tell me if I started an article that you were reading while I was out of the room.
Okay.
Automakers rebuffed on aluminum tariff relief.
You're good.
The Trump administration has so far rebuffed requests from Ford and other U.S. automakers for relief from aluminum tariffs after fires at a major American factory created supply bottlenecks for vehicles, including the F-150 pickup, according to people familiar with the talks. Last fall, two fires at the Novelis aluminum rolling plant in Oswego, New York, took the facility offline at least until this June. The fires occurred in the part of the plant where aluminum is rolled into thin sheets that are later stamped into automotive body parts. The plant is the largest domestic supplier of aluminum sheet for the U.S. automotive industry, serving about a dozen companies, including Ford, Stellantis, General Motors, and foreign automakers with U.S. production facilities. Atlanta-based Novelis, a unit of India's Hindalco Industries, has been making up for the lost production at Oswego with aluminum from its plants in Europe and South Korea. But the company's imported metal is subject to a 50% duty under President Trump's tariff regime. That cost is passed along to automakers when they purchase the aluminum. The disruption has most affected Ford, which relied on the plant for the aluminum exterior of its F-150 truck, the longtime best-selling automobile in the country. In recent weeks, Ford has petitioned the Trump administration for assistance, asking officials for relief from the duties at least until Novelis's Oswego plant returns to full service, according to people with knowledge of the conversations. The discussions are a part of continuing conversations between automakers and the administration about the impact of Trump's tariffs, the people said. So far, the administration hasn't budged, the people added. While conversations continue, Trump officials have also told the companies that they have already provided some relief from other national security tariffs last year when they allowed major automakers to recoup some of the tariff costs that they have paid for automotive parts, which are subject to 25% levies. A White House official said that while Ford and other automakers have raised supply concerns in light of the Novelis incident, they have not requested tariff relief on this matter in a particularly pronounced way. I'm not sure what that means. Novelis said it doesn't discuss aluminum costs for individual customers. Ford, which hosted the president in January for a factory visit outside Detroit, said in February it had already taken a $2 billion hit from the fires and expected to spend $1 billion more this year on imported aluminum from abroad. Steve.
Delta Airlines raises bag fees as higher fuel prices take a toll. Article by Connor Hart. Delta Airlines will raise fees for checked bags on domestic and select short-haul international routes, a move that comes as airlines look to offset soaring jet fuel costs stemming from the Iran war. Delta said Tuesday the price of first and second checked bags will increase by $10 each, while the cost of a third checked bag will rise by $50. The price increase goes into effect Wednesday, bringing the cost for first checked bags to $45, the second to $55, and the third to $200. These updates are part of Delta's ongoing review of pricing across its business and reflect the impact of evolving global conditions and industry dynamics, a Delta spokesperson said. Checked baggage benefits tied to Delta's frequent flyer programs, premium fares, and co-branded credit cards will remain unchanged. The company also said there will be no changes to baggage fees on long-haul international routes. The price increase follows a similar moves by other airlines, which are raising fares, adding baggage fees, and dialing back routes in order to cover skyrocketing costs of jet fuel, one of the biggest expenses that airlines face. JetBlue Airways said last month that it was starting to charge more for bags. United Airlines Chief Executive Scott Kirby previously warned that fares could shoot up as much as 20% because of war-related shortages of fuel. The moves are a side effect of the war with Iran, which has spread across more of the Middle East, creating tighter supplies of oil and petroleum products, such as jet fuel. George.
Thanks, Steve. Investors abuzz on combining Tesla and SpaceX. It's written by Becky Peterson. Elon Musk surprised onlookers with a quick merger between SpaceX and XAI. Now analysts, investors, and close Musk observers are debating the merits of what some see as the ultimate combination, SpaceX and Tesla. As SpaceX approaches an initial public offering, some investors are discussing the idea of a mega Musk merger as a follow-up. Musk has said he thinks his companies are converging, but he hasn't commented on speculation of a merger. Still, some Tesla supporters argue that combining the companies could accelerate Musk's artificial intelligence ambitions by bringing his projects under one roof and potentially create one of the most valuable companies in history. Alexandra Merz, that's M-E-R-Z, an influential individual Tesla investor who goes by the screen name Tesla Boomer Mama, posted on Musk-owned X that her best-case scenario is a stock-for-stock merger in June or July that values both companies equally. If such a transaction were to happen at today's valuations, it would give a slight premium to investors in Tesla, which has fallen 22.5% since the start of the year, according to FactSet. While she warned she could be wrong, she described her hypothesis as, quote, connecting public breadcrumbs. Others like James Robertson, a Texas IT executive, are more skeptical. Robertson, who bought shares in Tesla in 2014, said he worries a combined company would go the way of other failed conglomerates like General Electric, risking the success of both businesses. Still, he is eager to invest in the SpaceX IPO, which would be the largest in history when he gets the chance. I think it would be more valuable long-term to own stock in both companies, he said. Musk hasn't been shy about aligning his companies to achieve his life's ambition of building human civilization on Mars. Morgan Stanley's former Tesla analyst Adam Jones dubbed the project the Muskonomy. In recent weeks, other Wall Street analysts have picked up where Jonas left off, with some telling investors they see some logic to a merger. The main investor question we have received is whether Elon eventually plans to combine Tesla with SpaceX, thus forming a broader Elon Inc., an idea that TSLA mega bulls have frequently hoped for, Barclays analyst Dan Levy wrote in February. While at this point a Tesla-SpaceX combination appears less likely, we see the potential for a combination down the road, he wrote. SpaceX confidentially filed for an IPO last week and is aiming to stage what would be the largest IPO ever by July. The company was last valued at $1.25 trillion in February following its merger with XAI. Tesla, meanwhile, is already public with a market valuation of $1.1 trillion. A deal combining the two companies would rank as the largest merger ever. Musk stoked the flames with the announcement of new joint ventures between Tesla and SpaceX. Those include a new shared chip factory called the TerraFab in Austin, Texas, and a new AI agent called Digital Optimus that streamlines Tesla and XAI's software development. Steve.
Nonprofits are winning big with gambling. Las Vegas-style machines installed in some states yield a surge of proceeds. Article by Neil Mehta. The Mat Pack Wrestling Club, a nonprofit youth program in North Dakota, has increased its revenue 30-fold since 2017, not through candy bar sales or bake-offs, but from a multi-million-dollar gambling operation. It's hardly an outlier. Across the Great Plains state, sports leagues, tourism bureaus, and other charities have transformed themselves through gambling. North Dakota sits at the center of an unlikely experiment. Tax-exempt groups can install Las Vegas-style machines in restaurants, bars, and other establishments and watch the money roll in. An increasing number of states now allow them. While states legalize the machines to give struggling nonprofits supplemental revenue, groups have instead rewritten their fundraising playbooks. They find venues to place electronic pull-tab machines, ETABs for short, and often make money faster than they can spend it. Some tax-exempt organizations have bought pubs branded as casinos. A charity for the disabled runs four bars. I don't know if the public understands the scale at which charitable gaming is occurring in the state, says Sean Clary, a Republican state senator in North Dakota. It has gone well beyond the scope of what a lot of folks were intending. Players in North Dakota spend more than $2 billion on ETABs annually, directing profits to charities. The machines are now fixtures from bowling alleys to Applebee's. There is one for roughly every 100 adults in the state. Proponents say charitable gambling keeps nonprofits solvent and lets them expand their missions. Newly rich from ETABs, the Mat Pack Wrestling Club purchased an 18,000-square-foot facility and in 2024 distributed nearly $1 million in grants to other organizations, according to Internal Revenue Service nonprofit filings. Wild West. Gaming funds help us market Bismarck. The head of another nonprofit focused on tourism testified at a state Senate hearing. Without that money, she said, the organization wouldn't be able to help fund July 4th fireworks or rodeo days. Some lawmakers and researchers, however, argue that tax that lacks regulation has fostered a nonprofit Wild West. In central North Dakota, the Beulah Convention and Visitors Bureau is housed in a modest suburban office complex and promotes the area. The nonprofit's revenue surged past $750,000 by 2024 after it began sponsoring ETAB machines around 2021, up from less than six figures 5 years earlier, according to filings. But in early March, the North Dakota Attorney General sought to revoke the group's charitable gaming license and fine them, alleging that an investigation had found multiple violations of state gaming laws and regulations. In one case, according to the AG's preliminary findings, the nonprofit claimed to have donated over $270,000 to the Fenning Wildlife Museum, a tourist attraction, but instead opened a bank account under the museum's name, sent itself the money, and used a portion of the funds to pay its own employees' salaries and pay back a loan, among other expenses. A representative of the Beulah Convention nonprofit declined to comment. Its chairwoman said at a council meeting in March that her staff had been unfairly vilified. ETABS grew out of a decades-old charitable gaming laws that permitted smaller games like bingo and blackjack. But a wave of legislation in states such as Kentucky, Minnesota, and New Hampshire has added ETABS to the mix. In some states, they are less conspicuous. Minnesota's, for example, are played on electronic tables. Indiana has become the latest to legalize them in December. They are blockbusters wherever they arrive. For more than 3,000 nonprofits nationwide, a charitable gaming now constitutes more than half of their funding, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of IRS filings. ETABs descend from traditional paper pull tabs, a game of chance where strips hide symbols. Reveal the right ones and win a cash prize. North Dakota legislators, who legalized ETABs in 2017, said they didn't anticipate the game's wild success or how closely manufacturers would model them after slot machines. The trend is so lucrative that charities are entering the bar business. Aces Lounge and Casino in Minot is operated by a subsidiary called Ice Time LLC. Ice Time itself is owned by the town's nonprofit youth ice hockey program, according to IRS filings. Millions in income. In Grand Forks, a charity for disabled adults bought Southgate Casino Bar and Grill through a subsidiary. The group, the North Dakota Association for the Disabled, operates four bars and made over $4 million in net gaming income in 2024, its filings show. Southgate's offering include 3 blackjack tables, bar bingo, and 10 ETAB machines. The nonprofit's chief executive, Donald Santer, said the group spends roughly $3 million on direct services for people with disabilities and that the term casino is a marketing label. The sheer scale of charitable gaming forces lawmakers to weigh competing interests. A 2023 North Dakota legislative report found that ETABs are the source of most gambling addiction cases in the state. But many nonprofits now need gaming to survive. It can feed people's addictions for gambling, but also it's an economic benefit to people who are served by these organizations, said Democratic Representative Gretchen Dobovich, a public health practitioner. George.
For Chinese, American brands have lost their, quote, sexy cachet. Travails at Nike and Guess show how the nation's economies are growing apart. It's written by John Emon. American companies are flailing in China. Last week, Nike said revenue there was down by double-digit percentage and poised to get worse. California clothing brand Guess just closed down all its stores in China. Starbucks last year agreed to sell a majority stake in its business to a Chinese company, Boyu Capital, after running into tough local competition. A decade ago, American companies had pegged China as a top growth opportunity. The country of some 1.4 billion people was growing rapidly, and its young people were intrigued by American brands and fashion. Former Starbucks chief executive Howard Schultz predicted in 2018 that China would become the company's largest market. Instead, a bad situation has been getting worse in the past few months, a development that has geopolitical implications with President Trump due in Beijing in mid-May. Fewer American companies feel like they have a stake in good relations between the two superpowers, which is pushing Washington and Beijing toward managing a messy divorce. The poor performance of U.S. brands in China adds to other factors driving the two countries apart, including Trump's high tariffs on Chinese goods and each country's unwillingness to sell the other advanced technology with potential military uses. U.S. companies trying to hang on to a piece of the Chinese market are running into innovative local brands in industries such as ice cream, lingerie, and bicycles. A deteriorating property market has lessened the spending power of the middle class and encouraged people to look for bargains instead of foreign brands that charge a premium for cachet. It's getting more and more competitive and very difficult to commercially succeed now, unlike 20 years ago, said Eric Zhang, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. In November, Burger King's owner, Restaurant Brands International, said a Chinese partner would buy more than 80% of Burger King China in a bid to reignite growth. It became clear the situation needed to change, said RBI's executive chairman, J. Patrick Doyle, in February. American auto brands have seen their share of the Chinese market drop by more than half over the past decade to 5% in 2025, according to global data, after being out-innovated by local electric vehicle makers such as BYD and Xiaomi. Nike's announcement last week that it expected China revenue in the current quarter to fall 20% led its stock to fall more than 15% in a day, after the U.S. sneaker maker helped create a Chinese culture of exercise. Local rivals Anta and Li Ning are grabbing the market it built. Revenue earned in China by companies in the S&P 500 dropped but to 7.1% of total revenue last year from 7.5% in 2024, according to FactSet. Steve.
Automakers rebuffed on aluminum tariff relief. The Trump administration has so far rebuffed requests from Ford and other U.S. automakers for relief from aluminum tariffs after fires at a major American factory created supply bottlenecks for vehicles, including the F-150 pickup, according to people familiar with the talks. Last fall, two fires at the Novelis aluminum rolling plant in Oswego, New York, took the facility offline at least until this June. The fires occurred in the part of the plant where aluminum is rolled into thin sheets that are later stamped into automotive body parts. The plant is the largest domestic supplier of aluminum sheet for the U.S. automotive industry, serving about a dozen companies including Ford, Stellantis, General Motors, and foreign automakers with U.S. production facilities. Atlanta-based Novelis, a unit of India's Hindalco Industries, has been making up for the lost production at Oswego with aluminum from its plants in Europe and South Korea. But the company's imported metal is subject to a 50% duty under President Trump's tariff regime. That cost is passed along to automakers when they purchase the aluminum. The disruption has most affected Ford, which relied on the plant for the aluminum exterior of its F-150 truck, the longtime best-selling automobile in the country. In recent weeks, Ford has petitioned the Trump administration for assistance, asking officials for relief from the duties at least until Novelis' Oswego plant returns to full service, according to people with knowledge of the conversations. The discussions are part of a continuing conversation between automakers and the administration about the impact of Trump's tariffs, the people said. So far, the administration hasn't budged, the people added. While conversations continue, Trump officials have also told the companies that they have already provided some relief from other national security tariffs last year, when they allowed major automakers to recoup some of the tariff costs that they have paid for automotive parts, which are subject to 25% levies. A White House official said that while Ford and other automakers have raised supply concerns in light of the Novelis incident, they have not requested tariff relief on this matter in a particularly pronounced way. Novelis said it doesn't discuss aluminum costs for individual customers. Ford, which hosted the president in January for a factory visit outside Detroit, said in February it had already taken a $2 billion hit from the fires and expected to spend $1 billion more this year on imported aluminum from abroad. Automakers and other users of steel and aluminum products could be on the hook for even higher tariffs in the coming months after the Trump administration overhauled the metals tariffs last week. Under the changes, many finished products containing aluminum and steel will be subject to a 25% duty on the full value of a product instead of a 50% levy on just the value of metal. The tariff costs for many products are likely to increase with a lower tariff assessed on the entire product. Imported rolled aluminum sheets remain subject to a 50% tariff as a metal commodity material. That 50% tariff is already generally reflected in the cost for domestically produced aluminum as well. Buyers pay a separate charge on their metal purchases that covers various costs for delivering aluminum, including the tariff. This delivery premium is now about $2,500 a metric ton, according to S&P Global Energy. Ford and other aluminum buyers in the U.S. are paying the tariff in the premium, regardless of whether the aluminum they are using is made in the U.S. or imported. George.
Babylist hires its first marketing chief. Move by baby registry operator comes ahead of possible IPO, which run by Patrick Coffey. Babylist, a company that helps expectant parents build gift registries, hired Jill Kress as its first chief marketing officer. Kress had been marketing chief at tax preparation firm H&R Block since 2022 and previously held top marketing roles at PayPal and National Geographic. She's taking the helm of a roughly 60-person marketing department at Babylist as the company eyes a possible public listing as early as 2027, according to a person with knowledge of the situation. The IPO plans were earlier reported by Bloomberg. Babylist's revenue grew 45% to approximately $750 million in 2025, according to Chief Executive Officer Natalie Gordon, a former Amazon engineer who founded the company in 2011. It aims to hit $1 billion this year, she said. Gordon decided to bring on a CMO now to help increase the company's visibility beyond the younger and particularly first-time parents who make up its consumer base and to help the business expand in new areas, she said. Marketing had previously been led by Leanne Blake, who was chief growth officer from 2020 to 2025. Babylist is really, really well known by those who use it, but I think we've flown under the radar, she said. What are we really looking for in the next 4 or 5 years? We want Babylist to be a household name. The company earns most of its revenue from the direct sales of products and ad inventory on its website and app, as well as an affiliate link program that generates a percentage of sales on other sites. It branched into healthcare several years ago by acquiring SourceMD, a maker of breast pumps that are frequently covered by insurance plans, and Expectful, a health and wellness media company for new and expectant parents. A new Babylist money service planned for this spring will let parents add savings accounts for children to their registries and use them for future events like birthdays or holidays. Brilliant. We want the registry to really be the entry point of a long-term relationship, Kress said. Much of Babylist marketing is focused on educational content, including free webinars, Reddit question and answer sessions, and a newly released podcast. The company now intends to work with more celebrities and creators who can use its Los Angeles showroom as well as a recently announced location in New York City to showcase products in their content, according to Gordon. Steve.
And this is the Business World column that appears regularly in the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal. Robert Mueller and Trump, too. President Trump got appropriate grief after the death of Robert Mueller, whose departure the president applauded. If the press were a little more even-handed, a couple of points for Mr. Trump might have appeared in the ledger. The compendious information collected of U.S. intelligence agencies meant that Mr. Mueller knew, before he started his investigation, that no information existed pointing to Trump collusion with Russia in the 2016 election, only evidence of fabrication by his political enemies. For 2 years, Mr. Mueller withheld his critical knowledge from the American people about the man they had elected. His actions had consequences, and still do. I have readers who bought the collusion guff and still cling to it out of embarrassment. Far more consequentially, guess who wasn't blinded by their priors from seeing the truth? The 74 million people who voted for Mr. Trump in 2020 and the 77 million in 2024. That's why he's president now. All this is about to matter again. George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley provides an insight into last week's firing of Pam Bondi. Mr. Trump is readying his administration for a new spasm of investigations and impeachments if Democrats win Congress in the fall. Unless they have undergone a hidden reformation, you should also have serious doubts about whether Democrats will do their duty as an opposition party in a way that leaves the country better off. Take the criticism Obama Defense Secretary and CIA Chief Leon Panetta has been dishing out about Mr. Trump's Iran war, some of which is even cogent. He's unwise to open his mouth. In lying about the Hunter Biden laptop in 2020. Mr. Panetta not only behaved like Russia's Silvaki intelligence officials who meddle in domestic politics. In effect, he threw the Biden campaign on the mercy of Vladimir Putin, who during the final weeks of the campaign might have raised a stink, but didn't, about Russia being falsely accused to muddy the truth about a purely private Biden mess. 2 months after Joe Biden took office, Russia began moving tens of thousands of troops toward Ukraine's borders and into Crimea. In July 2021, Mr. Putin published an essay justifying his coming invasion. Unprovable is Mr. Trump's claim that the war wouldn't have happened if he'd been reelected. Provable is that Mr. Putin invaded when the White House was occupied by an aged, feeble president who had relied on Russian silence to protect him from his son's laptop scandal. Americans aren't always going to lie to themselves about this. At least their historians won't. Consider another piece of unspoken history. At a January 22nd House hearing with Biden administration prosecutor Jack Smith, the most important question went unmasked, though it certainly was on the mind of every politician in the building. Mr. Smith, aren't you partly responsible for reelecting Mr. Trump? Mr. Smith's prosecutions were unlikely to be resolved before Election Day. Mr. Biden was cheering them on. Everyone knew why. The reason could be found in a report by Mr. Smith's fellow special counsel, Robert Hur. It confirmed what a majority of voters already believed. Mr. Biden was too old. He was an elderly man with a poor memory. George.
Levi Strauss lifts outlook for fiscal year as sales rise. It's written by Kelly Clunan. Levi Strauss & Company bumped up its fiscal year guidance following double-digit sales growth in its latest quarter as the apparel company sees its turnaround efforts paying off. San Francisco company also said Tuesday that it has started a search for a successor to Chief Financial and Growth Officer Harmit Singh, who plans to transition to the role of Special Advisor before retiring. Levi's now projects revenue growth of 5.5 to 6.5% for the fiscal year ending November 29, compared with prior guidance of 5 to 6%. It now expects adjusted earnings per share of $1.42 to $1.48, compared with $1.40 to $1.46 previously. The forecast includes a headwind of 4 cents from higher tax rates and excludes Levi's Dockers business, which it has sold. The updated outlook comes after Levi's logged higher profit and a 14% revenue increase in its latest quarter, driven by growth across channels, regions, and categories. Thanks so much for listening. Please be sure to join us again tomorrow for another edition of the Wall Street Journal. Have a great day.